This is Sciographies, an introduction to the people who make science happen. I'm your host, David Barkley. I'm an oceanographer with the Faculty of Science here at Dalhousie University. And on Sciographies, I interview different types of scientists about what shaped their interests, their career path, and how they get their research ideas. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we talk to Melanie Massey, a PhD candidate in the Department of Biology. Her research looks at how temperatures influence organisms, particularly the cascading effects that some organisms experience when they're subject to temperature fluctuations in early life stages. She also dedicates her spare time to engaging BIPOC youth in science outreach and education through an organization she co-founded with another BIPOC PhD student, Diversity of Nature. This episode covers Melanie's experience growing up in Toronto's East Chinatown, how she's combined her love of art with her passion for science, and the importance of removing barriers to make science more inclusive. I think the best place to start is at the beginning. Can you tell us about growing up in the big city in Toronto?
Yeah, I grew up in what I consider downtown Toronto, so in East Chinatown, mm-hmm. which is the smaller of the two major Chinatowns in Toronto. It was a very busy and bustling community. There were always people out shopping. There were vendors selling vegetables on the side of the street. My school was really close to me. It was very multicultural, mm-hmm. being in the middle of this Chinatown with a lot of immigrants from Hong Kong.
And is it like a true big city childhood where like you could like order down food when you were like 5 years old?
Oh yeah, my mom would send me to the Chinese barbecue place as a kid and I'd just pick up the order. They'd just say, oh, Lancey's kid. Yep, we've got it.
Yeah. You just walk in, you say, the regular. I want the regular.
And they chop up a duck in front of me.
Yeah. So you went to a public school?
Yep.
And were you right away interested in science, or was there lots of different things pulling you in that early kind of education?
Oh, there were definitely lots of different things pulling me. I loved school and I loved mm-hmm. learning. I think I liked art the most. Mm-hmm. I was a big artist and still kind of am. I loved reading, writing. I was, you know, okay, I was good at math, but I wasn't really into it. And science wasn't a huge pull for me very early on. I just wasn't really aware of nature. I didn't go out in nature. I was in urban spaces. Mm-hmm. And before I left for university, I could probably count the number of times that I went camping on one hand. Mm-hmm. So I just wasn't really aware of the ecology around me.
And how about extracurricular activities? I mean, you mentioned art. Was that mostly in school or were you doing it beyond school?
I didn't really do art outside of school. It was always mm-hmm. classes, but I was always drawing on my own. And back then, you could go to the library and get a book on how to draw mm-hmm. and learn from that book. Yeah. There weren't really YouTube videos, so mm-hmm. I learned a lot from books when it came to art. In terms of extracurriculars, my parents got me involved in a lot of different things. So the city of Toronto was wonderful at creating programming for kids. Mm-hmm. I did swimming lessons my whole life. I was in synchronized swimming.
Oh.
And this was all city, you know, free city programming. Mm-hmm. I skated.
You know, I've seen your scientific drawings. But let's just say that you've got like shading level experience, like 1,000. Technical ability, lots of technical ability. I mean, you know, very detailed drawings of animals, but also some very interesting like design. Like you did was that a drawing you did for the Coast? Was that a cover or just for, it was for an article,
yeah, it
right?
was for an article by a friend of mine mm-hmm. and she was writing about being a Black woman in science and mm-hmm. being a first generation immigrant in graduate school. And I made this image that just illustrated how in everyone's scientific path, there are different roadblocks that we face. And so I tried to create that sort of metaphor yeah. where certain people might face more roadblocks because of their identity. Yeah. And it just creates this longer, more winding and dangerous path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really struck by that drawing and then looking at some of your nature drawings or scientific drawings, I guess you should say them, which were extremely like photorealistic. And that made me think, well, you must have really probably had an opportunity to really pursue that at a young age.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take a lot of art classes outside of school or any really. I think my parents didn't love that my life was going in an artist direction, but they let me kind of do it anyway. But when you get to high school and you get to choose your courses, I ended up taking all of the drawing and painting courses and really benefited from some amazing teachers at my high school. So it wasn't, it was a technical school. We had an auto body shop, we had a cooking program and a hairstyling program, and the arts were very valued at my school. So I had the opportunity to learn all of these technical skills.
Yeah. Your parents were somewhat discouraging, maybe subtly discouraging, of a career in the visual arts.
Yes.
How did that play out?
I mean, I'm a scientist now, so I suppose I sort of went down a path that they liked, although I don't think they really understand what a PhD is or what an academic is. Yeah. I think my mom really wanted me to do that whole doctor lawyer thing.
Mm. Let's talk about your parents a little bit. What did they do?
My mom is an internal auditor for the government in Ontario, and my dad does IT. He writes images for formerly IBM, but now TD.
So fairly like analytical family.
It's hard to say. I don't think neither of my parents are truly passionate about STEM, for example. Yeah. I think they just knew, you know, growing up in the 90s, STEM was an ideal career choice. It was a burgeoning field for women, and they thought it would be great if our daughters could get into that.
Okay, so in high school, you're fairly academically oriented, getting good grades.
Yeah, I was a big nerd.
Okay.
I was really into it.
Like, what level? Are we talking like, do you have things that you regret because you were like, I can't do that, I got to stay home and study, and like you miss seeing something like massive?
Yes and no. As some people who are listening may know, being a nerd in high school doesn't necessarily mean that you're socially inactive. In fact, it can be one of the most silly and fun sort of friend situations to be in. So, yeah, I don't know. I had a lot of friends that would work together, do study parties and...
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds really lame.
No, I get it. Hey, listen. I'm only asking the question because I know I've been there. As high school was sort of wrapping up, was it obvious that you were going to go to university?
Yeah, it was obvious I was going to do post-secondary. I've always loved school and I knew I wanted to stay in school, but I only really applied to two places. I applied to McGill University for a science program because I did really start enjoying the sciences as high school progressed, but I also applied to OCAD, the Ontario College of Art and Design, because I thought, okay, maybe I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
But in the end, I felt like I needed to get away from Toronto, so I moved to Montreal. I chose McGill to do that.
Classic rivalry. was it an easy decision to make?
Yeah, I think so. I was so excited to leave home, and I was 17 when I moved to Montreal.
Yeah.
So it was just this whole new French-Canadian world.
Yeah. And so did you go into a special science program? Or you just went to a regular, or a Bachelor of Science?
I joined the general Bachelor of Science program, but you declare your major in your second year. So I ended up going into biology, which had always been my favorite science.
Okay. And did you experience like a big learning curve difference from high school to university?
Not with my classes, to be honest. I think I was pretty well prepared and I really enjoyed taking all my classes, but the social learning curve was actually really hard for me. Mm-hmm. So I was still 17 when I started and I felt very young. I felt very, very inexperienced and it was moving into this ongoing, never-ending party going to McGill. There was a lot to adjust to in terms of the lifestyle and I loved the adjustment.
Yeah.
It was so much fun.
So tell me a little bit more about classes. You knew you wanted to do biology. Did you start to get into research early on at this point?
No, I didn't even know that that was a thing you could do.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess coming from a background where there aren't really people who did academic research or graduate school in my family or in my circle of family friends, I had no idea that that was something you could do. And I did kind of fall into it eventually. So I had a professor who gave a really wonderful talk on the Burgess Shale and the Cambrian explosion. And I was listening to this like, wow, my mind is being blown. I want to be that person who's digging up that fossil. And I ended up going over to talk to him just to say how interested I was in the lecture he gave. And he was like, oh, why don't you come help out in my ant lab? So it wasn't fossils. He was an Evo Devo guy. Mm-hmm. But I ended up starting to volunteer and get into that academic research situation.
Right. There's a lot of room for that in biology because there's lots of work to be done always, right?
So much animal care.
Yes. But your first animal of choice was ants.
I wouldn't say it was my animal choice, but I did it.
Animal convenience.
I guess I just wanted to feel like I was a part of this these moving cogs in research. And I loved this professor, Dr. Ahab Abouif, who's still teaching at McGill and thought his research was neat. But eventually I wanted to take a different direction into something I was more interested in. At the time, I thought it was going to be paleontology and ended up going on this big vertebrate paleontology field course with his colleague, Dr. Hans Larsen. And I spent a summer out in the Badlands of Alberta digging up dinosaur bones in the heat and showering maybe once. Mm-hmm. So that was a really fun experience. And also one of my first real experiences being outside and getting to experience nature.
You guys were sleeping in tents.
Sleeping in tents. Yeah. I was driving the F-150 with half of a license. They called me Moose Plow on this trip because I'm a bit of a speeder and...
You didn't hit a moose, though.
No.
Okay, good. Just a clever nickname. Okay, so this is a whole summer in the Badlands.
Yeah.
And collective camping. You're doing some of the cooking and cleaning as well as the digging.
Yeah, we were cooking these like giant paellas every night. I remember us gathering iridium dust from the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. So that's from the meteor that wiped out all the dinosaurs and sprinkling it on our paella. It's this sort of spiritual.
Yes. Wow. Sounds pretty cool, but yeah.
Okay. It was wonderful. And it was so nice just to get to experience being outside after growing up my whole life as this really urban person. Mm-hmm. At the same time though, I think I sort of reached a reckoning where I was sitting out in the sun digging up this hadrosaur rib and thinking, okay, this actually isn't that much fun anymore.
Right.
these things are dead. And I found myself eventually kind of running around catching frogs and butterflies with my professor's kid because I was so interested in all the things that were alive. And I guess that was a nice turning point, though. I realized, okay, well, maybe paleontology isn't great for me, but I do love the outdoors and all of these critters that are flitting about.
So that's when you took a true turn to commit to biology.
Yeah.
I noticed that you did a lot of like science education around this time, right? Or was that a little bit later?
Not quite at this time. A little bit later, though.
How did that opportunity sort of present itself?
So after I graduated from McGill, I was unemployed. I ended up moving back to Ontario, to Hamilton with my sister, and applied for a job as a mad scientist with a company called Mad Science. So they send an adult into schools in a lab coat, and we talk about different scientific concepts and do little experiments with the kids. And I think that sort of made me realize that I really liked this SciComm education component of science. But again, I think it wasn't enough. I think I knew I still wanted to do more, but this could be something that I continued to do and continued to have on the side.
Yeah.
So eventually what happened with that was I was getting asked by teachers and principals to come back outside of work to talk about my own experience because they really wanted, I think, someone to come in and be this role model and talk about the things that they've actually done, like digging up dinosaurs in the Badlands or catching fish in Maine. So I was getting requests a lot and realized that there's actually a big desire from the community for this sort of programming.
Right. Was there any other research that you got to partake of in your undergrad?
Yeah. I took a bunch of different sort of research directions in my undergrad after sort of realizing that I really liked this. And I saw the grad students around me just being so happy and really enjoying what they did and thought, okay, maybe this is something I could do one day and I should continue to volunteer in these labs. So I went out the next summer as a field assistant, and for this I was actually paid. We were looking at the effects of hydroelectric dams
yeah.
in water bodies, so specifically the drawdown that it causes.
Yeah.
And I was part of a little crew of all women. Mm-hmm. We lived outside in rural camping conditions for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was primarily responsible for catching fish and then dissecting them mm-hmm. to get otoliths and gonads. So I probably dissected thousands of fish that summer.
Wow. But despite this, you wanted to enter the workforce, or you weren't too sure what to do? Grad school wasn't an obvious choice.
I knew I wanted to go to grad school eventually, but really, I just didn't have any idea of how to get there. And mm-hmm. no one who was close to me really gave any good indications of that. Like, my parents didn't really understand this grad school system.
Yeah.
And sort of what ended up happening was I just kept missing deadlines. So mm-hmm. in order to get to grad school, you have to apply sometimes more than a year in advance.
Yeah.
And by the time I was finishing up my bachelor's, I wasn't really ready to do
right.
that. So it just didn't happen. And I figured I would take some time and do some work and think. I wasn't planning to go into kids education.
Right.
I just thought I could do some right. job. But it actually ended up being really good for me to take some time. Mm-hmm. I was still very young. I graduated when I was 21. And I think just having some time to work gave me some more maturity that allowed me to be capable of completing
right.
a graduate program.
So where did you end up going
for
grad school?
Yeah. Eventually, I was shopping around. I was doing yeah. a lot of research on different professors. But eventually, I landed on a new professor at U of T. I remember scanning the ecology and evolutionary biology website mm-hmm. over and over again for months and not really seeing anything that really stuck out to me. And then one day this guy appeared on the website.
Okay.
He had just been hired as an assistant professor.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he had a lot of experience studying eggs and life history. And at that point, I was really into developmental biology still,
mm-hmm.
just based on my experiences with Evo Devo and paleontology.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to apply to his lab.
Yeah.
And what sounded really cool about his stuff was that he was mentioning ectotherms, ectothermic vertebrates,
mm-hmm.
so turtles and salamanders.
Right.
And I thought, this is totally what I want to do.
Animals that get their heat from lying on hot rocks.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so tell me about your foray into grad school. What was it like?
I loved it. I love yeah. being in grad school. And mm-hmm. it's funny because you often hear scary stories about grad school where people are very sad and overworked.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, I found it really freeing. I felt like I got the chance to ask my own questions and then come up with my own answers. And I was working on turtles during my master's, which are a really fascinating system and really charismatic too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everyone loves turtles. So I got a chance to try out a whole lot of different things. I was out in the field in Algonquin Park, monitoring and watching turtles as part of this extremely long, I think a half century long
wow.
study on turtles. And so every year, these young researchers come out to a field research station in Algonquin Park and wake up at 5 a.m. and watch these turtles from the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really interested in their nesting. I worked, again, primarily with their eggs. And something really cool about many turtles, as well as fishes and crocodiles that people don't know, is that their sexes can actually be determined by the temperatures they experience during incubation. So it's okay. not a genetic XY system like we have. And that's when I sort of got interested in these plastic changes that can happen
yeah.
to organisms as they develop.
Was there a climate change aspect to this research?
Yes. So I was looking at the sex ratios. And as an example, one of the concerns under climate change is that the direct effect of temperatures on the sexes can drastically change these sex ratios. So, for example, in sea turtles, we're seeing that shifts towards hotter temperatures are actually feminizing mm-hmm. a lot of baby sea turtles. And we have sex ratios in some areas that are like 99% female and 1% male hatchlings being born. So there is some concern over these unbalanced sex ratios, mm-hmm. although with the snapping turtles that I was working on, we weren't really seeing that.
Right. And did you get to spend, you spent two summers out there or one, just the one summer?
I was actually able to spend three summers out there.
Wow. Now, you didn't stay at U of T to do the PhD.
No. I mean, I would have been happy to stay there, but mm-hmm. I think I wanted to get some different experiences yeah. elsewhere and maybe even travel some more. I wasn't ready mm-hmm. at that point to really settle down. And so, yeah, eventually I ended up applying to Dalhousie. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to really go ham on developmental biology and really get into that micro work mm-hmm. and apply to a lab associated with Dalhousie. But after about 4 months there, I realized that was not going to work for me. I want to be outside and
yeah.
working with animals, thinking about nature.
So you made the jump. You found another lab.
Yes. So it was a bit of a transition. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to take 4 months off where I was just kind of thinking about where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. And ended up reaching out to Jeff Hutchings, mm-hmm. who incidentally was my advisor's advisor.
Wow. Tell me how your research is going so far, and what exciting field work have you done to make it happen?
Yeah, so interestingly, I'm not doing field work, but I'm still happy. I'm working on a species called zebrafish, okay. which are their popular pet species, and they're also an extremely popular medical research model. But instead of doing medical research or microbiology research with these zebrafish, I'm actually looking at them from an ecological perspective. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking these fish and I'm incubating them under changing environmental conditions. So specifically yeah. right now, I'm looking at thermal variability. And all of this is relevant to climate change. So we know that temperatures are on average getting warmer globally, but they're also getting more variable. So we're seeing short-term climatic events like heat waves. We're also seeing higher highs and lower lows. And so what I'm doing with these fish is exposing them to these temperatures and seeing how they can plastically respond within and between generations to this thermal variability.
Right. And how do zebrafish handle the higher highs and the marine heat waves?
So their zebrafish actually do have a very high heat tolerance, and I recently just finished an experiment I was doing where I was exposing them to super, super hot temperatures and essentially seeing how hot they can go. Mm-hmm. And what was really cool that I recently found out was if they're exposed to changing temperatures when they're a baby, it can actually prime them as an adult to have a much higher thermal tolerance. And so what they experience throughout their lifetime can really have these cascading effects.
Yeah, I mean, it's very obviously on our minds with, for instance, the two heat domes that have struck the West Coast. Do you feel that, you know, although you're really in the nuts and bolts of the research, that in a sense there's like a hopeful aspect to what you're looking at in terms of addressing climate change?
Yeah, I think so. I think we miss a lot of the complexities of what these animals are capable of by only looking at constant temperatures, which tends to be the situation for most research in thermal biology. But I do think with some of the experiments looking at thermal variability, we're seeing an animal may be able to tolerate a really, really hot temperature if it's only going to be for a few hours. But also plasticity itself is a way that they can cope. And I think that, yeah, my research makes me hopeful because they may not be able to evolve as fast as is needed with the rapid rate of climate change, but they may be able to acclimate.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I guess I mean, I just want to get into some of the activism that you've, I mean, I think we can call it activism, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose the seeds for that may have been planted in Montreal because outside of McGill, Montreal was a little bit hostile towards mm-hmm. cultures that were not Francophone Québécois or even Anglophone Québécois for that matter. So it was one of the first times that I really experienced racism was moving to Montreal and having people refer to me as an Asian expletive or mm-hmm. something like that. So I was suddenly confronted with this racism that I didn't really think existed in, you know, 2010.
But interestingly enough, you took those experiences as seeds for work back on campus, right? To encourage sort of BIPOC engagement in STEM.
Yeah, I was working with a group called the Canadian Association for Girls in Science. Mm-hmm. So I really started working with young women and girls because that space had been created for that type of programming.
Yeah.
And it was only recently at Dal that I started thinking about creating programming that's specifically tailored for BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and people of color students so that they can experience STEM with mentors that look like them.
Mm-hmm. Here at Dal, do you feel that your organization, Diversity of Nature, is supported or could be supported by the school itself, or is it much larger than that?
Yeah, Dalhousie has been very accommodating, mm-hmm. although partially one of the reasons for this is that there was a need for it.
Yeah.
A program like this didn't exist before. And it's not just for the students who come to the program, the community members who are taking part in the programming, but it's also for the students that run it. It's a really rewarding experience for us as graduate students to be able to teach, to be able to mentor younger students, and to have the creativity to create our own immersive activities.
Yeah. Can you tell me what some of those activities like? Can you paint a picture for what you guys do as a group?
Yeah. So the whole idea behind our program is we want to take the skills that graduate students have and really highlight BIPOC graduate students. So for example, I do scientific illustration on the side. So that would be my skill. And what I would do is create a program that highlights my skill, like scientific illustration, and actually shares it with younger students.
Right.
Another example is we had a student, Hunter Stevens, who is like a dive master. He goes diving a lot and he's a really great naturalist, just can identify everything. And he ended up taking all of these kids out to go scuba diving. And for many of them, it was actually their first time swimming in the ocean.
Now, the program sounds amazing and the activities are, you know, were super interesting to hear about. And going back to, we talked a little bit about this drawing you did for this article on the coast, and the article was about the various barriers that people of different identities encounter or don't encounter. And I was wondering, do you have really personal experiences of that, or what are your ideas and ways to address these issues? What advice can you give?
I will say that a lot of advice about this has been tailored to people of color themselves. We often get told things like, you know, develop a community of support and, you know, try to defend yourself. But really, the onus of dealing with these barriers should be on those who have power. A friend of mine, Suchinta, and I actually just wrote a paper on this where we give advice to powerful people in the academy, explaining what they can do to help make our barriers go away. And some of this is funding. That's a huge barrier. So many of us face financial barriers coming from first generation families. Reducing these financial barriers ends up creating a more equitable playing field for everybody. So that's a good place to start. I think in my experience, I'd like to hope that I haven't been prejudiced against or negatively judged because of my race or my gender, for example. But I have experienced just situations that are culturally uncomfortable. So for example, walking into a field station and realizing that everyone around you is white. Mm-hmm. And it just creates a very isolated feeling. And so we can try to make things more culturally engaging and more culturally broad for everyone to participate in. That might mean, you know, making an effort to hire more field assistants that come from different diverse backgrounds. It could also mean even just serving Chinese food instead of spaghetti one night at the field station.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's little steps that everyone can take just to make people feel more included and reduce those barriers.
Well, it's been super interesting talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
In our next episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Dozier Okoye, an economist who studies the influence of Western education on economic outcomes in Nigeria. If you enjoy Sciographies, hit subscribe and maybe give us a rating too. I'm your host, David Barkley. Thanks for listening. Sciographies is brought to you by Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science and CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Our producer is Nicole Killowey. You can learn more about Sciographies at dal.ca/sciographies.